Welcome back to the program. In the movie Wall Street, Oliver Stone told us that the only thing worse than not having money is to have had money and lost it. Such is certainly the case with the family of Bernie Madoff. But before we can sympathize, we need to understand the question that Howard Baker asked 35 years ago. What did they know, and when did they know it? That question has become kind of a touchstone for Mark, Andrew, and Ruth Madoff and the rest of their family. Today we're going to spend some time trying to get an insight into answering that question with my guest, Laurie Sandell. She's the author of a new book entitled Truth and Consequences, Life Inside the Madoff Family. Laurie Sandell has written for Esquire, GQ, Glamour, and InStyle, and has contributed to New York and the Wall Street Journal. It is my pleasure to welcome Laurie Sandell here to talk about Truth and Consequences. Laurie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Why did the Madoff family decide to talk to you at this point?
Well, they have actually been wanting to tell their story from the beginning, but, you know, due to the ongoing legal situation, they have not been able to. Now that some time has passed, they were ready to tell their story, and I, of course, had a sort of unique connection to this story, which is that I'd written a memoir about my own father, who is a con artist and has perpetrated, you know, pathological liar and had done a number of things.
Talk a little bit about why they felt the need to tell their story. What is it that they wanted to convey?
Well, they felt the need to tell their story because they have been vilified by the entire world. The entire world assumed that they were in on the scheme, that they at the very least knew about the scheme, and that's exactly what I assumed when I first met them. You know, I first met Andrew Madoff's fiancée, Catherine Hooper, when I was reading from my first book, The Imposter's Daughter, and when she told me she was engaged to Andrew Madoff, this was at the time September of 2009, and I, like the rest of the world, assumed that the brothers who worked side-by-side with Bernie for 20 years had to have known, that Ruth, who had been married to Bernie for more than 50 years, had to have known. And it was really not, you know, in the initial stages of our acquaintanceship that I changed my mind. It was 2 years of, you know, getting to know them slowly and then 6 intense months of sitting down and doing interviews that it became very clear to me when they very, you know, kind of took apart the way the business worked. And with Ruth, you know, took apart the way the marriage worked, that I came to understand that they really didn't know. And so from their perspective, they wanted nothing more than to be able to just outline this in a very, you know, step-by-step way for the rest of the world, which assumed, you know, without any investigation, that of course they knew.
What was the turning point for you when you really began to truly believe that they didn't know?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I, of course, came into this as a journalist, and any journalist and any person really would have kind of been very interested to get to the heart of this story, to sit down with these people and ask them the tough questions. And so for me, when I had this initial invitation to go to dinner at Andrew Madoff's house, simply because, you know, they had read my book and they felt some kind of kinship just in terms of our background and our experiences, I was very excited, you know, just out of pure curiosity to hear what they had to say. And those first 2 years that I saw them, you know, very briefly in kind of social settings, I was holding them very much at arm's length, feeling that, you know, am I dealing with a sociopath here? Am I dealing with someone who, you know, has helped to perpetrate one of the biggest white-collar crime in history? And when I finally, after 2 years, they were available and ready to sit down and to talk and to tell their story, I sat down with Andrew for many, many hours. And he told me the way that the businesses were separated. Now, I had read, of course, the articles in Vanity Fair. I had read all of the news that was out on this. And to me, I felt like, well, okay, one business is on the 19th floor, one business is on the 17th floor. That wasn't enough to convince me. But when Andrew explained that all of the things that, you know, played into this, for example, there was a lack of a succession plan. Bernie's parents had died young, in their early 60s, within a year of each other. And due to that, Bernie was terrified of his own mortality. Conversations about his mortality in this household were verboten. He refused to get yearly physicals. He wouldn't get checkups. He couldn't talk about his health. So when the boys came into the firm in high school as interns, of course they took everything their father said at face value. Now, their father's asset management business was on the 17th floor. The brothers were brought into the 19th floor, which was a completely separate business, and that was the proprietary trading business. They came in as interns, and then they were eventually given their own pads and became traders, and then eventually they went on to become the head of the respective sales and trading desks. And so Bernie's teaching them everything they knew, but as they're coming up in the firm and they're starting to understand and really get a grasp of how, you know, these businesses work, they said, "Dad, you have to tell us about the asset management business, because what happens when you pass away and we're left holding the bag and you have all of these clients and we have no idea how much money you're worth, how much, you know, what you're managing, what that business is about." And Bernie would shut down the conversation immediately, saying, "I gave you, you know, your business, this is my business, and my end of the business is going to die when I do." Andrew was the person who really pushed and pushed Bernie to, you know, he would constantly challenge him. Mark was much more, you know, passive with his father. And basically, Bernie would shut him down. And eventually, Andrew tried to leave the business because he felt like, if I don't know, you know, what's happening with the asset management business, my father is going to be prickly about that, then I can't continue in this business and take it over as I'd planned to do. And Bernie wouldn't let him leave the business.
Did Andrew have any suspicions that there were things going on, that there was a reason that Bernie didn't want him to know about it?
Well, no. I mean, Andrew, like the rest of the world, Andrew, of course, was well aware of his father's eccentricities, you know, a lot of obsessive-compulsive disorder-style eccentricities. But Andrew, like the rest of the world, what he saw was this man of legendary stature who was, you know, for all intents and purposes, some of the most sophisticated investors in the world were giving him a large amount of money to manage. He was the chairman of NASDAQ. He was constantly showered with awards. So as far as Andrew was concerned, he saw a man who was a genius.
How much of understanding do you think the family dynamic here, the way this family grew up, the things that were important to them, how much does that dynamic tell us about why Bernie Madoff did what he did?
Well, I think it's less about the family dynamic and more about the Bernie Madoff who was created, you know, by his own upbringing. And I think it's really hard for me to speculate about why Bernie Madoff did what he did. I'm not sure that we'll ever know why he did what he did. If I had to sort of go from an armchair psychology perspective, I would say he's a sociopath. That's what I see. But I chose not to interview Bernie for this book. I basically decided that I wanted to tell the family story separate from Bernie's story. They'd been so entwined with his story throughout this entire process, and this was a chance for the family to speak. So I wouldn't want to speak to why mm-hmm. Bernie did what he did. But the way the family dynamic played out made it very clear why they did not know.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between Bernie and Ruth Madoff, a relationship that goes back to the time they were both teenagers.
That's right. Preteens, actually. Ruth met Bernie when she was 12. There was a party that was thrown in a friend's basement that had been kind of set up to look like a nightclub with a jukebox and lights. Ruth spotted him across the room. She was instantly smitten, and they were together ever since. They got married when she was 18 years old. Ruth was 18, Bernie was 21. And even from back then, he was very fastidious, very controlling, and Ruth had gone directly from her parents' house, a very sheltered existence, to Bernie's house, and she was trying to make her fastidious, picky husband happy. She was, as she described it, a teenager with, you know, piles of clothes everywhere, and so from the beginning, Bernie was very picky, very controlling, and Ruth was trying to just kind of do things right. And she very much came of a certain era, of a certain cultural time, and to know what your husband is doing is actually something that I think many women of that era didn't know.
What did she know, but what did she want to know about the business over the years?
Well, as far as, you know, what I got from Ruth, I don't think she wanted to know much about the business. She didn't challenge Bernie on much of anything. I mean, early on in the marriage, she became aware that he was probably having an affair. And she tentatively sort of reached out a feeler about it. He shut it down, and that was the end of it. And again, you know, she was someone who saw her husband as someone of legendary stature and the way that he moved in the world and the way that the world lauded him. And it's not so much about her, you know, just enjoying the spoils of this and not wanting to know where the money came from. It's a person who grew up in a marriage from a very young age. He, you know, step by step accumulated more wealth. All of their friends around them were accumulating more wealth as she was. So to a certain extent, it was just normal. They were just accumulating more wealth and, you know, moving up. And she was very happy raising her children and working on their charity foundations. And, that was what her life was. On top of it, Ruth was a drinker and is, and essentially was, you know, drinking her wine and raising her children, and that was the way she lived her life.
How did she see the charity work?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, Ruth told me that she wishes that she could look back and say that she had this incredible drive to do charity, but again, there was a little bit of a stupor going on there. You know, she wrote the checks. She certainly was, you know, managing the foundations and that sort of thing. But it really wasn't until after the scandal happened that she really became involved in charity work. I mean, now she's doing Meals on Wheels, and she's volunteering at a school, and she's really thrown herself into charity work in a way that she's doing it with her life and her time as opposed to, you know, writing checks.
Does Ruth understand the scope of the damage that this scandal caused to so many people?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that people don't understand, and one of the reasons that my book has some measure of sympathy for Ruth, is that Ruth, every single family member, every single friend, every single person in her entire circle was decimated by her husband. So for Ruth not to understand the scope of the damage, it's very much hits home. I mean, her sister, who's in her mid-70s, is driving a taxi and taking luggage, you know, lifting heavy luggage up and down stairs. She does not have a single friend left in the world that she can say is a friend. I mean, basically, the decision to stand by her husband of 50 years, simply because she really didn't know what else to do, cost her absolutely everything.
And it also impacted her relationship with her sons. Talk about that.
Very much. Ruth was a woman who, for whom her sons, you know, the sun rose and set around their mother. And when Ruth decided to stay by her husband, who had overnight destroyed their lives and their reputations, that for them was it. Bernie confessed to pulling off this fraud in the penthouse apartment in December. And as soon as he did that, Mark yelled, you know, stood up and ran out of the room, and that was actually the last time Ruth ever saw him. Andrew also did not speak to his mother again. The first time Andrew spoke to his mother was right after Mark killed himself. So she completely lost her relationship with her sons as a result of this bad decision to stand by Bernie, but as Ruth puts it, she really didn't know what else she could have done.
In retrospect, now that a few years have gone by and she looks back at it, does she see options? Does she see other things she might have done?
Well, I think, you know, the way Ruth has described it, she wishes that she had done everything differently. I mean, she wishes that she had left that day and moved in with her sons, which certainly they would have taken her in. You know, she wishes that she had listened to the friends that implored her to get out of that apartment and then leave Bernie, but she was so psychologically entwined with her husband of 50 years, not to mention in love with him. You know, this is a man that she loved and adored and looked up to and respected for 50 years, from when she was a child. So in her mind, she didn't have a choice and couldn't have done anything differently, but she is nothing but filled with regret. Her son is dead. You know, her husband is in prison for the rest of his life. And she lives her world is very small now. So she's nothing but filled with regret.
When she looks out at what the rest of her life might be, what does she see?
Ruth, unlike her son Andrew, who really has tried to pick up the pieces of his life and make something different out of it, Ruth very much sees a bleak landscape, and she's filled with despair and in a way doesn't want her life to get better. You know, I mean, Ruth has a certain personality type in a way, but she sees the fact that all of her friends, all of her family, and then these thousands of people around the world, that their lives were destroyed. So for Ruth to think about, you know, what her life can be in her early 70s, starting from scratch, it's just not something she wants to think about. She really does take it one day at a time, and that's the best she can do.
And the relationship between Ruth and Andrew at the moment?
I would say their relationship is healing. When I started this process, they were tentatively, you know, speaking. Now, I first got to know them before Mark killed himself. So at that point, the relationship was fractured, completely fractured. They weren't speaking at all. They had their first moment of reconciliation when Ruth flew to New York, and this is all in the book. Ruth flew to New York after Mark's suicide and met with Andrew for the first time at Susan Elkin's house in Connecticut. Susan Elkin is Mark's first wife and the mother of his two oldest children. And Andrew remembers seeing his mother, and she looked completely frail, and her hair was this brassy, strange color, and he did not recognize her at all. And she just fell into his arms sobbing, and he was not in this incredibly forgiving mood. You know, it really took time. And I watched the relationship as I interviewed them. I watched the relationship change and shift, and I watched Ruth come to some understanding of why her sons had done what they had done. She really couldn't understand why her sons cut her off so abruptly and intensely. And I saw Andrew come to understanding of why Ruth stayed by Bernie's side. It was something that was so hard for him to understand.
Talk about Andrew and how he is trying to reassemble his life.
Well, Andrew, in a way, out of every person that's been touched by this in the immediate family, he's the person who's kind of the luckiest, because he was separated from his wife when this scandal happened. His wife had committed infidelity, and so they were separated. He had met a woman named Catherine Hooper with whom he had worked in the fly fishing world. She's an entrepreneur who had owned a fly fishing shop that Andrew had frequented for many years. And over the course of several years, they fell in love, and they ended up, you know, they were starting this brand new relationship and had moved in together just 2 days before the scandal broke. So their entire house was empty and in boxes. Now, while Mark went into his house, drew the blinds, read every single article that was out, and gave equal weight to a Wall Street Journal and a blog post that was telling him to kill himself, Andrew, by contrast, you know, was in this relationship, this very solid relationship, and Catherine said to him right from the beginning, Andrew, you have to go to lunch. The day this happened, she said, go out to lunch, hold your head high, you did nothing wrong, you do not need to hide in the house. And that is the way that he chose to approach this, and it made all of the difference. And now, Catherine has started a business called Black Umbrella, which is for emergency preparedness for families. Andrew is working on the business with her. Of course, his assets are frozen, and he can receive no proceeds, but he is working on the business, helping her to build it. And he is very much picking up the pieces of his life. He has two daughters, wonderful daughters. His oldest daughter was, you know, graduated number one in her class from Dalton and is now a freshman at Harvard, and his life is moving forward.
To what extent was there a potential desire on Andrew's part to just change his name, leave the country, move as far away from all of it as possible?
Well, that's exactly what Andrew said he wanted to do right from the beginning. He wanted to change his name, leave the country, move as far away from this as possible. But again, it was something that Catherine, you know, told him right from the beginning, no, that's not what you're going to do. And I think when he saw it, there was a very poignant moment that Andrew told me about his daughters in the days after this scandal broke, when his youngest daughter, Emily, had come home and there was a bat mitzvah that she was going to have to go to 2 days after the scandal broke. And she was saying, I'm not going to the bat mitzvah. I don't want anyone to see me there. And Andrew realized in that moment that he had to, you know, tell her, no, you hold your head up high, you're going to go to the bat mitzvah, your friends are going to embrace you. And it was something that as he was telling this to his daughter, it was something that he realized he had to do for himself.
Is there a sense that Andrew has that maybe 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that there will be yet another story to tell about this, looking back and talking about the experience?
Well, that's a very interesting point. I mean, I think that obviously as the story unfolds, there's a lot of different perspective that comes into play. I think Andrew has said that he feels very differently about it even 3 years on than he did when all of this happened. He's a different person than he was 3 years ago. I mean, this was a person who was steadily moving forward in his father's firm. He and his brother, of course, were going to take over someday, and that was the trajectory of his life. And now the trajectory of his life has completely changed. And in many ways, he's actually been freed from a life that really wasn't his. And I believe that, you know, he, for example, read Diana Henriques' book, mm-hmm. wonderful book, The Wizard of Lies, which is kind of the definitive book on Bernie Madoff, and she's the lead financial reporter for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And Andrew, when he read Diana Henriques' Wizard of Lies, he said that he was just so overcome with emotion, even understanding the lengths his father had to go to pull this off, that his father had such a depth of evil. It was just something that he couldn't comprehend. This was a man that he looked up to, admired, and adored his entire life. So 20 years from now, as we sort of are able to put this into some kind of context and have greater perspective on it, of course, I think it'll be interesting for everybody looking back on this.
And Ruth still talks about not necessarily being angry at her husband?
Well, Ruth has talked about having difficulty being angry at her husband, which is something that is very hard for people to understand. This has been the major sticking point between Andrew and Ruth, is Andrew trying over and over again to sit down with his mother and to walk her through it and to make her see and to help her understand exactly what has happened here. Of course, she's angry at her husband in a, you know, basic way. I mean, she understands that her life has been destroyed. But psychologically, she's so entwined. You know, she was with him for 50 years. She was with him from when she was a child. She grew up with Bernie Madoff. So even after he has destroyed her life, is responsible for the death of her son, direct contribution to that, and the fact that he repeatedly cheated on her throughout her marriage, she still, she understands what she has said is that if she really allows herself to get angry with Bernie and to say, wow, look what he's done, he's destroyed the lives of thousands of people, he's destroyed my life, my family's life, what her biggest fear is that her entire life had no meaning and that it was a waste. You know, and so for her, she is having such a hard time, in her mind, letting go of these wonderful memories, because she had wonderful memories of this family for so many years. And to look back on that and say the entire thing is a lie is just devastating for her.
And does she still have the desire, do you think, although she's cut off contact now with Bernie, does she have the desire to make contact, or does she not do it because of Andrew?
Well, certainly when this process started and, you know, I was starting to interview them, 100% she was not making contact because of Andrew. It was very much Andrew's condition of their relationship that she cut off contact with Bernie, and that she, and there wasn't much contact to begin with. She visited him 4 times in prison and that was it. But he said, you know, no phone calls, no contact, because he understood that when she's under his spell, it's very hard for her to see. And he wanted to get her away from his father. And so now, yes, she is starting to come out of it. She does not have any contact with Bernie and doesn't, and says that she doesn't want contact with Bernie. But, you know, you also have to understand this is a woman in her early 70s who's never lived alone in her entire life, who is staring out at the bleak landscape of her future and thinking, what next? And the way she described it to me, and it was actually very poignant to me, is, you know, I'll never be understood like that again. I'll never be loved like that again, you know? And so I think there's just this feeling of her life is over. That's the way she describes it.
Tell us about the relationship between Ruth and Catherine Hooper.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, Catherine Hooper, who is Andrew's perpetual fiancé, because due to the laws in New York State, Andrew cannot divorce his first wife. When she first came into the family was incredibly skeptical of her motives. She had grown up with no money in upstate New York. You know, she kind of, as far as they were concerned, she came out of nowhere. She wasn't Jewish. Who was this woman? And the family viewed her with a lot of skepticism, and they were not welcoming. And that's something that still is very irksome to Andrew when he looks back on that. Through this process, her relationship with Ruth has completely transformed and changed, because Catherine really is the person who has brokered the reconciliation between Ruth and Andrew. And Ruth is well aware of the fact that Catherine has essentially saved her son's life. And so Ruth is incredibly fond of Catherine now. But it took years. I mean, and it certainly was not going to happen before the scandal happened.
And what is your sense of why Catherine has stuck around? I mean, yes, she has the relationship with Andrew, but she could have gotten out early on.
She certainly could have gotten out early on. It's 100% nothing other than the fact that she's very much in love with him. She's very much in love with him, and even though they weren't able to get married, she does believe, you know, till death do us part, in sickness and in health, and for better or for worse. And this is a situation that she's just determined to see him through. And certainly, if the love weren't there, I think she would have left a long time ago, as many of her friends advised her to do.
And how do her friends view her relationship with Andrew and with the family?
Well, you know, now, much like me, I think they had a similar journey that I did. I think in the beginning, her friends were just shocked to find out that Andrew was worth what he was worth. I mean, I think when the scandal broke, and again, Andrew himself didn't know what he was worth because they didn't know, you know, the kind of money that his father was managing. But I think when the scandal broke and hit all of the papers, Catherine's friends were completely shocked that she was, you know, involved in a family that had this level of wealth. Then, of course, they were very skeptical, and, you know, many of them thought, well, what is she doing? I mean, obviously this guy knew. And once Catherine was able to explain to them, as Andrew was able to explain to me, as Catherine was able to explain to me exactly the mechanics of how this worked, and they came to understand, they've become incredibly supportive. And in fact, it's really Catherine's friends and the friendship she's cultivated that have become, you know, the foundation of their social circle.
Laurie Sandell, the book is Truth and Consequences, Life Inside the Madoff Family. Laurie, I thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.